He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin. This is Car Keys.
Good morning. And we are going to discuss, or Jay is going to discuss, high horsepower vehicles and their worthiness in the today's relevant automobile market. Jay?
Oh, I'm up?
You're up.
All right. Robin and I talk about this on a regular basis, you know, high horsepower cars and the trend that we've been seeing in the last, since ever we've been producing cars, I guess. But
last 3 years, though.
Specifically in the last 3 to 5 years, we've seen cars reach insane amount of horsepower. And I was just going through a list that was published a week or two ago of the 25 fastest sedans in the country. And all these cars make anywhere from 300 plus to
700 plus.
700 plus horsepower. And we just saw coming, driving over here, I was reading a magazine in the car. I was not driving, so I could do that. And Chrysler just came out with the Challenger at 797 horsepower. Those numbers are just insane. Now, in Chrysler and Dodge's Challenger and the, what's the other one, the Charger, the problem with the 700-800 horsepower is you're transmitting the power to the rear wheels only, and they become a little tricky to drive. Most car manufacturers, high performance manufacturers now, like Mercedes, BMW, and Audi, have gone to all wheel drive, even on their designated
performance models.
Yep. So. Anyway, you see a lot of cars with reaching 0 to 60 times in under 4 seconds. There are 20 or 25 cars on the market, which is, and Robin can attest to this because I believe you have a car that was in its day one of the fastest sedans on the market, right?
And that was when it was under 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Close to 4 to 4.5, and that was those were the fastest accelerated times.
What is the new holy grail for acceleration?
Well, the problem is more about traction and all that
as opposed to what they can do.
The holy grail, and the 0 to 60 time is not really an indication. It's an indication of off the
bragging
line.
Rights,
right.
Yeah,
of your car.
Quarter mile.
It's a selling point.
It's a selling point.
But
we're talking
who can afford it.
Tesla 100. What is it called? The Tesla S 100 PD has 680 horsepower. It's an all-wheel drive car.
And it has a ludicrous mode.
And it reaches 60 miles an hour in 2.3 seconds. And what is absolutely insane is that there's no need to rev the engine. It's an electric motor, as we know.
And it doesn't blow up.
But it uses up a lot of electricity doing it, and you won't get 300 miles if you continuously use the ludicrous mode to get 0 to 60.
Just out of curiosity, you know, for someone who doesn't have an electric, who has an internal gas gauge because, you know, don't like to be below a certain
question.
How much electricity does it use to do that?
That's a good question. I don't know. Jay might, but I don't.
I don't.
But, you know, the Bugatti Veyron, one of their 1,000 horsepower models, talk about ludicrous horsepower ratings. the latest Bugatti Veyrons are ludicrously pointed with 1,000 horsepower gasoline engines. And they suck through a tank of gas if somebody tries to run it at its top speed in, I think, 25 minutes. At full power, so you're not going anywhere. You're not going to go 300 or 210 miles or whatever an hour for a long time, or you're not going to go 0 to 60 or 0 to 100 in electric ludicrous mode for a very long time before you have to either recharge or refuel.
I guess the point is it gets to be crazy. I mean, I have a friend who's a race car driver, professional race car driver, who says when you try and do a 0 to 60 in that Tesla, it physically hurts. If you are holding the wheel and you just slam on that right foot pedal, your forearms will physically be in pain. It is painful. Just even with a regular car, try it. You know, I drive a diesel on a daily basis, and if I'm at a stoplight with somebody in the car and I put it in sport mode and just try to beat everybody off the line, people look at you and think you're just crazy or there's something wrong with you. So 0 to 60 speed is just, it's a number.
It's a something number for advertising and sales purposes to those people who wish to be able to tell their best buddies that they have a car that can do this. Seldom do they do it. You know, when you see that they've done it is when you go down on a, see a patch of road with tire marks, dual tire marks, zigzagging down the road, and somebody was in a pickup truck with a 400 horsepower engine or something, and they were who knows what they were on besides gasoline and fuel, but they're trying to show off their rig to either a passenger or the public who might be following them down the road. Gasoline goes and or diesel goes through the motor pretty quickly. You go through tread wear and tires pretty quickly, and most of the tires on these cars that can do these ludicrous speeds levels, attain these speed levels, the tires are expensive to replace. So if you're going to buy one of these cars, you know, you might as well, you better have the purse to.
Well, if you're going
to
buy one of these cars, presumably you're going to go to a track or someplace because it's not something you can really do on the road, is it?
Well, no. The Dodge Challenger that Jay was read about on the way over is a street legal car that is sold for the street, not for the going to the track.
I see people like that on the sawmill, for example. You know, and it's just really kind of interesting how. You know, their need to drive their car fast without thinking that there are other cars and so forth.
Oh, it's a fantasy of mine to drive the sawmill and break the record, and I don't know what the record on the sawmill is.
From what, one end to the other?
One end to the other. I would
That's
love to do it.
That's the border.
Round trip. It's a fantastic road. The curves are absolutely a lot of
I'm talking about when there are actual cars there.
Well, you go around them. You pass them. The problem is, and now let's be serious for a second. It's an absolute no-no. There is no way.
But it's not just that.
It's not reasonable. But will not be able to do it. You'll get caught.
But it is also, you'll die, which is, you know. But the bigger problem is trying to do that anyway when there are cars there because, hey, it's fun. And I'm not just talking about with motorcycles. We see this every couple of weeks. There's someone who just, you know, doesn't like the other traffic. So they're doing stuff that's just irresponsible and unacceptable.
I'm going to go on the limb. I'm a lot less worried about people on the road driving fast because they actually want to drive fast and they have an idea of what they're doing as opposed to people who are, and I always get back with commuters on, let's say, 684, who are just in a hurry to get back for whatever reason back home and who are driving, slicing through traffic, who have no idea what they're doing. Those are the people I worry about.
Possibly, we're talking about the same. It's the slicing through traffic, and slicing through traffic just happened the last time to be someone with a very, I mean, perhaps they just aftermarket put on something on their car that was very noisy, but they seemed to really appreciate the rev more than anything else.
The rev or the noise?
The noise of the brum.
Well, we've talked about the pickup trucks with those mufflers.
It wasn't a pickup truck.
Those diesels particularly, when they're, I think they're 4-inch or 5-inch pipes coming out the back.
This was not one of those. And this is just, as I said, maybe it was aftermarket.
You know, so there's a lot of aftermarket sales out there that we don't see in the northwest corner. I heard some statistic that there's like $2 to $3 billion in aftermarket sales of accessories that people do to their trucks, cars, Jeeps, SUVs, whatever, every year.
It's fun too.
The aftermarket accessories have always been
fun.
Well. It's harder now on new cars because the cars are so complex. It's a lot harder to retrofit a bunch of accessories. I mean,
performance accessories, but you can still add on decorative accessories. And the thing about that I note about that is usually come time to sell those vehicles, you're not going to get anywhere near your money back for those accessories that you spent possibly thousands of dollars putting on your rig.
No, you usually have a negative value.
You usually have a negative value.
Sure.
So it's really just something that is has no nothing
has
to,
do
with
individuality.
Intelligent spending of money. It's just individuality.
Yeah, but right. In this vastly marketed universe, sometimes a little individuality goes a long way. Do you have another? Is there something that you love that you want to talk about?
Yes, I want to talk about extended warranties. because just like in the real estate business, you get calls from mortgage companies saying, let's give you a home equity loan or something and consolidate all your credit card debt, yada, yada, yada. There are the other sales pitches for extended warranties. They come in the form of mail, and I've recently in the last month received three mailings from actually the same company as far as I can tell, because it's the return address is the same location. And I've also received some calls on a telephone line suggesting that I ought to be calling back to be sure I don't lose out on an extended warranty program.
Presumably
for my car, which they have no idea what the car is. They don't give you a VIN number.
It's a phishing expedition.
It's a phishing expedition.
So
I've found that most of those plans seem to cost somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000, depending on the plan they can sell you. And there may be some value to them, but I have said on this show before, and I'll say again today on today's show, that you should, if you want to buy an extended warranty, I think you should do it through the manufacturer whose car you own if they offer one. And you can get it through the dealer, or you can get it, as I did with my Jeep, lifetime warranty, extended warranty program, directly from Fiat Chrysler. The mailings that I'm getting in my mail are not from any known company, corporate entity that is known for selling extended warranty programs. And I think there's sort of insurance programs. They may be okay. I can't tell you they're not, but I'm very suspicious that they're going to get your money. And depending on whether or not the car they have sold enough of these programs, they're self-insuring themselves by selling you these programs, and they put the money in the bank, and then they hope that they can pay out and still have money to pay out later on if your car has a major breakdown with it. So I stay with the recommendation that you stay with the named programs that are usually available through the manufacturer of the car that you want to have your warranty on, and or the dealer that you bought your car through.
All right.
Jay may have another opinion.
No,
I'm not sure.
No, I agree.
Sure.
So I would just, if you get these in the mail, listeners, or you get calls, I would not return the calls unless they're from somebody you know, connected to the dealer, and I would not call the number on these mailings that come in, because you're going to be given a sales pitch, and it's going to be hard to get off the phone. I went through a couple just to hear about them some months or years ago, and they haven't changed, I'm sure, in today's
I'm sure that most of them come in through email anyway at this point.
No, I don't get. I don't know. I'm not sure. I recognize email, but they are snail mail and my telephone at my house.
Okay.
How they get those numbers, I'm not sure.
They're all on the internet.
Okay. Next, Jay.
So we were talking about high horsepower cars, and I just remember, you know, and we talked about it last week, you know, and I'm comparing high horsepower today and what high horsepower meant 20, 25 years ago. And I was going back through some old magazines, and, you know, basically high-end luxury sedans, you know, foreign, whether Mercedes or BMW, were like 280, 300 horsepower was like the max. And so, you know, I started thinking, okay, well, what were we all driving 25 years ago? What were the hottest cars 25 years ago? And interestingly, the top-selling models in different segments of the market were pretty much the same nameplates we find today. The Toyota Camry, the Honda Accord were already best-selling cars 25 years ago. The BMW 3 Series. The Mazda Miata MX-5, you know, little roadster, which has remained true to its original concept, you know, not a lot of horsepower, still a very fun car.
It's a very well-balanced car to drive.
I had a 92 a few years ago and recently drove a 2016 or 17, and it feels exactly the same way. You just go back in time. So I was just wondering what I know what I was driving in 1993, and just for giggles.
I was driving very mundane sedans in the 90s, mostly for my business, and they were four-door sedans of generally Mercury versions of Ford twin sister Ford's versions of the same vehicle. I can't remember the model names at the moment because they just escaped me, but they were, some had four-cylinder engines, some had six-cylinder engines. I did have Grand Marquis versions of the Crown Victoria when they were actually had the Lincoln Continental dashboard designs before they started getting generic with the Crown Victoria designs back in that era. But they have that wonderful Ford 302 V8 in it, and the Crown Vicks and the Mercury Grand Marquis, and those were bulletproof engines, and you could put 150,000 miles on them and get $39.95 oil changes all day long, and nothing ever broke. We've come a long way since that era of car. The big ones have disappeared. They're coming. Some of them come back in the form of the newest Lincoln Continentals, but.
The point, though, is, or I suspect, is that the names are the same.
A lot of, no, yeah, well, the names, some of the names are the same. I mean, Robin is talking about the Grand Marquis. We know that's a Mercury, and the whole Mercury brand is long gone. But the Ford Crown Vic's been around, or was around, until I think 2011 or 2012.
And they lived on in the Continental. The old version of the Continental superseded them for the
but
limousine class.
But yeah, a lot of the nameplates are still the same. I mean, high performance cars. Porsche still has a 911. Chevy still has a Corvette. And the layout and the mission of these cars is still generally the same. And right. And so, as much as we'd like to think the auto industry is evolving very fast and is changing rapidly, it is still a very, very conservative industry overall.
Yeah. But I was, apropos or vaguely, but I was struck yesterday of watching a bunch of football and the a sedan, a vehicle that is being very heavily advertised as a young person's, it's like your starter car is a Toyota Corolla. Now, if you've lived long enough, you will have remembered your starter car as a Toyota Corolla.
That's absolutely true. And they're wonderful little cars, actually.
The point being, it is, you know, like, here we are. I'm not going to count the number of decades, except that I remember.
Was it a rear-wheel drive still?
I don't know the answer. It was just the way that it had been pretty much half a century later, turned into a, like, hey, you want this. And you're now at this juncture, that's your grandfather. Your grandfather had it when he was a kid, so it doesn't matter.
They were bulletproof cars.
Absolutely.
They 200,000 or 300,000 miles on a Corolla.
You would put your kid in it. It wasn't, you know, the
reminded me of the Ford Cortina. And Jay was around enough to know that. Those were great little cars, and they were built in England, I believe, at the time.
Yep.
They were imported into the U.S., and there was a time when I wanted a Ford Cortina. The worst way in the world, I couldn't get my parents to buy one. It was a neat car.
They actually came out back. I don't even know. I was a kid.
You were barely born. I think.
I don't know if I was barely born, but Ford came out with the Cortina with a Lotus engine back in the late '60s or '70s, and that was a terror of a car in those times. Yeah, and it probably made all of 100 horsepower, or 120, or something like that.
Yeah.
And we would laugh at that now. but so yeah, a lot of the cars are still the same.
It's just a question.
I think the major change we're going to is in the drivetrains, with the electrification of the drivetrains that is fast coming upon us. Isn't there a Scandinavian country in Europe that's going to demand that just about every car sold in their country is by 2000 something or other is going to have to be electric? Or electric hybrid type of variant?
Yeah, I forget. I know, Norway had, the city of Oslo is banning cars altogether. I mean, the automotive picture in Europe is changing, and it is changing here too, but it is changing in Europe faster than it is
it
here.
It generally leads.
European cities have taken bold moves in outlawing diesel cars
in the cities.
Right. Which in a certain way makes sense, but the other thing that it's hard to have this conversation and just have a direct comparison or correlation, because there is a rail system, there is a mass transit that is just not available here.
True.
And there's just, you can't, there's nothing more to say except, right, if you can get from here to there without using a car, without going through massive shifts.
Jay said in the car and the ride over here, he said the kids, the 14-year-old kids or whatever, are using what? They need cell phones and Ubers. They don't need cars, and they can't drive at 14, but that's the way they get around. The question is, when they can drive, are they going to just keep using Ubers right up through their adult lives or not? And unless they have a need to travel outside of their lifelong living area, which would be where they're working or something, they may never need a car. And of course, there's been periodic discussions about that amongst the automobile executives and experts for a number of years now, whether or not the car sales were going to go down the tube because the Ubers were going to take over. And I don't think it's going to happen the way that it's not going to be a doomsday situation, but I think we're preparing for sub-17 million or sub-16 million or maybe even sub-15 million car sales years going forward. I don't know that Jay will agree or not, the car manufacturer's been blessed with 17 million plus car sales for a number of years.
Fascinatingly, when the car business was not doing very well about 10 years ago, when whoever the CEO of whatever company decided to fly instead of walk to Washington.
Oh, yeah, that was when all the CEO parked their Gulfstreams and started flying commercial and in the back of the cabin. Yeah,
right. But you have to remember that. I have to say that I am a skeptic just generally, and I'm not sure what they've done with those 17 million cars each year anyway, except sort of ship them out to, you replace them, and then the ones that were there go someplace else.
Well, that's what happens, because there isn't 17 million new drivers every year that's buying cars. Mm. You are trading in, you are coming off lease, you are upgrading because you just have to have the latest model, and so the one you get rid of ends up on a lot somewhere, and it either gets moved into a lower economic scale that can buy those used cars, and they're in very good shape, many of them, and they're going to go another 100,000 miles for the next user, but they aren't the latest and greatest, or they go south of the border, or they get shipped out of the country.
Well, and I get back to that. I think that if you're on a budget, if you're spending $10,000 or $15,000 on a car as opposed to buying a new car at $35,000, which I think is about the median
average
sticker price. But if you're spending $10,000 or $15,000 on a car, yes, you have a couple entry-level small cars. Remember that little Mitsubishi three-cylinder that you had as a rental or replacement car?
Oh, yeah.
Which was pretty cool. But for the same kind of money, you can buy a very nice used car that will go another 100,000 miles. I think cars are built a lot better than they were 10, 20, 30 years ago. And you can get 200,000 miles out of a car without any kind of problems.
Absolutely correct.
In our final moments?
In our final moments, I just want to say that I will not be here next week, but I will be traveling to Europe, and I kind of look forward to looking at what's new out there and talking about it in a couple of weeks, different cars, different ways of driving.
And the other thing that I would ask you to look at, because I am just
quick
all the quickly, is what's actually out there versus what we're being told is out there.
Okay.
I will.
I want to get into check your tire pressure. I recently, with the arrival of cold weather, found that on two of my vehicles, my car tire pressures were 6 pounds below the recommended setting. They showed up on monitors on the gauges, but one told me where the tires each were, and the other one just said I had low tire pressure, and I thought maybe I had a tire with a nail in it. But when I checked them all, I found they were all down below 30 pounds per square inch, and they're all recommended to be at 36. And as I have said before, for every 10 degrees of temperature drop, there's an approximate reduction in the tire pressure of 1 pound per square inch. They will go back up when the weather warms up. So the question is do you set your tires at the recommended pressure at 0 degrees and then they go up to 45? Or where do you set the pressure is what I'm going to ask my next service rep when I take a car in for service.
Mine has never – I just want everyone to know that as when the light comes on, it never goes off unless I – it's just never happened. But I'm still – anytime. He is Robin Leach. He is Jay DeMark, and this is Car Keys.